Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, July 9th, 2025 on 91.7 FM WHUS Doors. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Okay, so got some health updates on both of us. Ron is not with me today because he is recovering from his surgery. He had his surgery a couple weeks ago in June. At the end of June, and he had a complete rebuild on his cervical spine. And watching him go through the recovery is really something. He has a lot of pain, and he has to be in a collar all the time, and he's basically been laying around the house. The first few days were pretty rough, and in fact, we had to go get him back to the ER in Wyndham for pain management. But after that, he started to improve, and we had to figure out different things to do for his pain management. He's on a number of medications. He had to take some opioids, some acetaminophen. He'd been on, first they put him on diazepam out of the hospital, which is a benzodiazepine. And they said that diazepam is a very good muscle relaxant, which I had never thought of it as. It is a benzodiazepine. So it's an anti-anxiety drug, but it also relaxes your muscles. And then when he was suffering with so much pain, a few days later, on the Saturday after the surgery, he was having a lot of pain to the point where he couldn't even sit up or eat or go to the bathroom or anything like that. And so we were dealing with the visiting nurses, and he does have visiting nurses coming every few days. And so when we dealt with the Visiting Nurse Association, they were able to call the surgeon, and they got the on-call doc who prescribed him Robaxin or methocarbamol, which is directly a muscle relaxant, not an anxiolytic, an anti-anxiety drug. So we started using that with him and not the diazepam. Now, I don't know what's going to happen when we go back to the surgeon. His surgical visit is this Tuesday coming. I'm not sure what they're going to say about pain management because he's not taking opioids now. And when he takes the opioids, that make him very dopey. So, and you know, he really can't function. After we went to the ER, they had given him, when you go to the ER and you have a lot of pain, one of the first things they usually give you is ketorolac. And ketorolac, I have been given that, and they usually inject it either intramuscularly, or if you get an IV put in, they put it in the IV. And it works really well and really fast. So they gave him that, and they also gave him Dilaudid, which is hydromorphone. And they gave him that in the ER, and then they prescribed it, and then we were unable to get it because there's a shortage. I'm going to go to the pharmacy today and see what's there because I know that the doc re-prescribed more oxycodone, but he's not taking oxycodone right now. He's not taking any opioids right now. He's just taking, so at the ER, they also prescribed ketorolac in pills. And when you take ketorolac in pills, it can be hard on your stomach. So I make sure that he drinks his protein shake every day. That's the first thing he has in the morning. I make it at night, and then I give it to him in the morning. And this is Ron's protein shake, in case you're curious. So we put in some chocolate almond milk, just a nice brand of chocolate almond milk. I put in a scoop of bone broth protein powder, chocolate bone broth protein powder. I get an entire frozen banana. I slice it up because it's easier to blend when it's sliced. And then I put in a whole small avocado. When I get to the big avocados, I'll probably give him half. And then 2 tablespoons of ground flax seeds. And when I had strawberries, I put a few strawberries in. So the strawberry season, I think, is done. I may get, shipped strawberries from the store because they taste nice in the protein shake. Now, we have raspberries growing out back. I may grab those and go pick some raspberries and throw those in. And the chocolate with raspberry, the chocolate with strawberry tastes lovely. So I'm sure he won't be upset by that. He needs the extra fiber because when you're lying around, and especially when you take opioids, you don't go to the bathroom as much. You don't go, you don't have bowel movements as much. So when he hadn't gone for a few days, we gave him a dose of senna. They had given us senna, and I was worried about giving him the senna because I didn't know if he could make it to the bathroom, and I thought senna was very stimulating. But when I talked to the nurse, I found out that senna is not crazy stimulating, and it helps you draw water to the stool, so it makes it easier to pass, and it's not overly contracting. It does have anthracene glycoside, like its neighbors, Cascara Sagrada, and Cascara Sagrada has anthracene glycoside, so does rhubarb, and I think rhubarb and yellow dock, the docks also have some anthracene glycosides in them, but definitely rhubarb. And we wound up giving him two senna pills, and the next day he went and he never needed them again. I was so psyched because he started going every day. It was great. So we only needed to do one dose of senna. That was great. So don't be afraid of senna if you absolutely have to take it. I mean, you don't want to take it all the time because you will become dependent on it. But in our experience, it didn't make him run for the bathroom. It just worked and it was helpful. And we didn't have to give him like a stool softener pill, because that protein shake has a ton of fiber in it. It has the avocado and the banana and the strawberries and the 2 tablespoons of ground flax seeds. That's a lot of fiber, so it really helps. So if you want a good shake in the morning, that's something to consider. You know, a little bit of your favorite dairy. If you do dairy, you can put a little dairy in it. If you don't, you can do your favorite dairy substitute, chocolate or vanilla or whatever, and whatever fruit you want. Avocado, a whole one, a half one, whatever you want to do, and frozen banana if you like that, and or whatever other fruit you want to do. You could throw greens in it, but he wouldn't appreciate that, so we don't do the greens. If I had a smoothie, I would do greens, but we didn't do that for him. So anyway, so that's working. So the pain, managing the pain is a lot. And when you have your neck rebuilt, they go in, they hit a lot of nerves, and they hit, they open up the muscles, so the muscles have to heal. And that's very painful. So lifting his arms is painful. Sitting up for a long time is painful. But he's getting better and better. And he's much more self-sufficient now. And so he's actually downstairs watching the Tour de France right now, or snoozing in front of the Tour de France. He does spend a lot of time sleeping. He wakes early in the morning like he always has. And he's in the habit of waking up in the 5 or 6 o'clock hour, and which causes me to wake up too. And then I run around and get him his meds and his protein shake. And then I have a hard time falling back asleep. And that is not my time of day. So I stay in bed. Maybe I sleep. Maybe I look at my phone and look at the news, which is just upsetting. But anyway, and so today I got up early like that, but I did loll in bed for a bit. And then, you know, hopefully later today I'll get to do some more relaxing. I do have some running around after making this show. So anyway, he's on the mend. He's certainly better than he was a week ago. And every day it's a little bit better. And he's determined to, he's now going up and downstairs on his own. So he likes to, he has a man cave downstairs where he watches the TV and has a nice recliner. And so he can lie down or he can sit up in the recliner. Also, for another thing he's using for pain is ice. And we had some small ice packs that he would put on his back. At the place that hurts the most are his lats, the muscles at the top of his upper back. And we actually wound up purchasing a very large ice pack that you can actually strap to yourself. That's almost like a small blanket. So it's very big and it covers a lot of surface area. So he's been using that. He hasn't been strapping it to himself, but he's been lying on it and he likes that a lot. So that's really good. So he's on the mend and we're figuring out meds. We're going to go see his surgeon on Tuesday and we'll see how that's going. So as far as I am concerned, you know, I have this ongoing femoral neuralgia and was diagnosed with spinal stenosis with the worst part at L2, L3 and not as bad at L3, L4. And they didn't jump to surgery for me right away. They said, you're going to start by having a cortisone injection. So finally had the cortisone injection a couple of days ago, and I was so terrified the night before. I was afraid they would deny me because I was so anxious. My blood pressure was spiking, and I understood that you don't give the shot if your blood pressure is too high. Well, I got there, and my blood pressure was high. Everybody was so kind to me. They let me sit. They took it on the other arm. They let me calm down, and it would come down. And then... And they did the procedure anyway. So I went to UConn, and I had my friend Pat drive me. And they had told me that when I had my visit with them in June, they told me that I would be able to drive myself home. But when I got there, I noticed that I decided that that was not a good idea because I had no idea how I was going to react. If I had a reaction, I needed somebody there to drive me. So I got a friend, my dear friend, Papo, who's our neighbor, and he drove me to the visit and waited for me, which was great. And when they were, you know, checking me in, they said, who's going to drive you home? And I said, Papo, and there he's right over here. And they said, great, we will take his phone number. And when you are finished with your procedure, we're going to call him, and then he can bring the car around for you. So that was great. So then what they do is they take you. So first of all, you go to UConn. It's really top notch, let me tell you. So go Huskies. Here I am on WHUS saying great things about, you know, the care at UConn. It's a schlep to get from Mansfield, where I live, to Farmington, but worth it. Worth it, because I've heard stories about other places that people go to get injections. Maybe they have a good experience other places. I don't know, but I heard some other stories that weren't so great, but I had a wonderful experience. The worst part of the injection was me, the anticipation. Getting a spinal injection, you know what's worse than getting a spinal injection? Getting your teeth done, getting Novocaine or Carbocaine, and having your teeth worked on and having your tooth ground down for a crown, way worse than what I experienced. So you get there and they wait on you like you're a queen, really. You get in there and they put you in a little bay with a curtain over it. And they're very kind. They're very nice to you. Nobody freaked out when they saw my high blood pressure. They just let it come down. And then they explained to me, okay, you're going to take off your clothes. You can leave your panties on, but you put on a Johnny. Put on this Johnny open in the back, and here's some hospital socks. Put that on, and you have to put on a little surgical, you know, one of those surgical shower cap looking things. So I had to do that, put my hair up and put it in the cap. And then I got to relax, and they sit you in a recliner, and the nurses are really nice and friendly and stuff. Everybody's really nice. And then the resident came in to talk to me, Dr. Monaco, and he explained, he asked me if I had any questions. And of course I did. And I, you know, was asking, okay, so my understanding is that this is going to help to calm down the structures, but it's not going to correct the stenosis. And I know that I have the worst stenosis L2, L3, and then I have a little less bad at L3, L4, but it's going to make those structures, anything that's inflamed, it's like the discs, and it's going to make the ligamentum flavum calm down. He said, wow, why do you know all those terms? Are you in the medical field? I said, yeah, I'm a naturopathic physician. So he said, yes, it's going to calm things down and we're helping you with pain relief. So that's mostly what it does. It doesn't correct the stenosis. It just, all the structures that are inflamed, it allows them to calm down. So that was fine. And so then I had to wait a little bit longer, which was nice because I had to lie back in the recliner. Oh, and also you have your Johnny on and they come and they bring you a warm robe also. And it is, of course, dark blue, you know, UConn Husky blue. So they put that on your back. And then when time comes, that when Dr. Walker is ready, they come and they wheel you into a surgical suite. And it's a great big surgical suite. It's brightly lit. And they have the resident and the physiatrist who did the procedure. His name is Joseph Walker. Very, very lovely man. Very smart and jovial and pleasant to talk to. And I think they had at least one nurse in there. I'm not sure if they had another assistant. I can't remember. It was at least three people in the room. And it's a really big room, you know, so for whatever reason. And so what they do is they're giving me the injections in my back. I had to lie face down. I thought maybe I'd be decubitus, you know, I'd be lying on my side. But no, they make you lie face down. And they gave me a pillow. They said, put your face in the pillow. I'm like, how am I going to breathe? So I pushed the pillow in front of me and put just my forehead on it because I'm used to doing that for some yoga poses. And they said, well, if you want, there is a hole in the table. And if you can put your face through, your nose through the hole. I said, great. So I moved the paper or the sheet and I had the hole in front of me and I put my forehead on the pillow. And that was great. And that worked. And then they gave me little squeezy balls to hold on to, small yellow squeezy balls. And they wanted me to put my arms over my head, you know, above my head, relaxing on the table. And I could play with the squeezy balls if I wanted to. That was very interesting. And so then Dr. Joe comes over, and it is a dye-based procedure because it is fluoroscopy, so they have to put dye in you. I had no idea if I would react to the dye, and I did not. I asked my mother before the procedure if she had ever had dye, and she had, and had not reacted. He told me what he was doing, and then, you know, they put in, I believe they put in lidocaine to numb the area, and then they inject the cortisone. And as he was working, he said, you know, it's really tight in this L3, L4. I think I'm going to have to go in L4, L5. It was tight in the L3, L4 as well. So fine. So that's what he did. And in terms of pain, it is worse to get your teeth done. Also, this procedure is maybe 5 or 10 minutes. It's really short. I mean, you're there and then it's over. It's crazy. So, so you're lying on your face, lying face down. And I'm used to being stuck with needles because I get acupuncture all the time. And I'm not one of those people who's afraid of getting blood drawn. So it was really not a big deal. So he did the lidocaine, and then you could hear him talking to the resident. And he would say, he would stick in a needle and he'd say picture. And he'd say stick in a needle and he'd say picture. Which meant that while that was going on, he was taking an x-ray of my back. So he could see what he was doing. And so that's the thing. When you get a cortisone injection into your spine, they have to do it under fluoroscopy. They have to do it you can do injections under ultrasound and then you don't have to have dye. But for the back, they generally do it under x-ray with fluoroscopy. So you have to have dye. And so this guy was very professional. He was cute and fun, but also very precise and very professional. I felt very safe and I felt like they really knew what they were doing. It was very impressive. And, you know, and then he would stick in when he would do the injections, when he would go in, you could feel it pressing against some nerves. And I asked him, so it is an epidural. And that means you don't breach the dura. That's why it's called an epidural. He said, that's right. If they miss and they go in through the dura, then that's bad because then you're going to get fluctuations of cerebral spinal fluid and you can get the cerebral spinal fluid headache. So that didn't happen. I was worried about all the side effects of cortisone shots, like the cortisone flush. I was worried that I would have extra pain for a couple days. I was worried that I would have a stroke. These are all side effects. Now, having a stroke is very rare, but cortisone flush could happen. And being a little sore is more likely to happen as well. None of that happened. Nothing bad happened. And at the end of the procedure, when he was done, I asked him if I was going to react to the dye, would I have reacted already? And he said, most likely. Well, I never reacted to the dye. The only thing that happened was I did feel a little wobbly on my legs when I stood up. And they said, that can happen. And, you know, that's why you should take it really easy today. And what my hope was, you know, my best hope, I mean, I worried about everything going wrong, of course, but they also made me get there for 7:15 in the morning, and I am not an early morning person. But it was a blessing in disguise because they were loading me into Pat's car at 8:30 in the morning. The whole thing was done. And my best hope was that, you know, Pat loves to eat ice cream, so that I would take him out for ice cream afterwards, and that I would feel well enough to do that. And yay, I did. But it was 8:30 in the morning, and ice cream isn't open at that time of day. So I said, okay, let me see if there's a nearby cafe that's open, and we'll go for, for beverage and a treat. And I looked, and I'm like, oh, Glastonbury, we're going to go to Rangina's. And that's what we did. And that was open. That opens early because cafes are often open because it's worth it because people come before work to get their coffee. So Pat doesn't do coffee. He does tea. So he had tea and a croissant, and I had a matcha latte. And so I'm going to report on this next week. I asked them if they had ube at this cafe, and they said yes. And she started pouring. So I said, okay, I would like an ube latte with matcha in it. And the guy said, you want a matcha latte with some ube in it. I said, okay, fine. So I had a matcha latte with almond milk and ube, but it wasn't ube, it was taro. And the young woman that worked there didn't realize that there was a difference. I'm like, yeah, they're different plants. Taro is a special kind of root, and sweet potato is a sweet potato. You know, ube is a sweet potato. And it's a beautiful purple sweet potato, very popular in the Philippines. And I learned about the ube because my nephew and niece-in-law have a dog named Ube. And it's a little brindle French bulldog who's Meshuggah. Anyway, so that they named the dog Ube, which is very cute. And then I learned that the Ube was this purple sweet potato that's very popular as a flavoring. And it's becoming a sort of a niche flavoring in general. Like, you can get it at various cafes here in the U.S. It's like a, you know, sort of like avocado toast. It's a popular thing to get. But they didn't. So I had to explain to her that taro and ube are not the same thing. But it's fine. Put the ube syrup in the latte, and I'll have ube. And I said, you should get ube. But that's fine. I'll do the taro with the matcha, and that's great. I bought ube powder online, and I'm going to make myself a green tea ube latte at home, because I haven't been to a cafe that actually has ube yet. So that was great. And I was a little wobbly legged, but I was able to get into the cafe, no problem, and get back to the car, no problem. And then we stopped at Dee's One Smart Cookie because it was late enough. They don't open till 10, but we were there long enough so that we made Dee's One Smart Cookie. So that was great. I could bring some treats home. And so that was the best possible outcome. And then the next day, soreness didn't happen. I thought I maybe had a cortisone flush yesterday, but on the 4th of July, because I had the procedure on the 3rd, and on the 4th of July, I decided I was going to go to the Boombox Parade in Willimantic without Ron, unfortunately, because there was no way he was going to make it there. So it was a little more walking than maybe I should have done, but not too bad, because I had to park the car somewhere and then get over to Memorial Park. But I managed to do it, and I was okay. So I don't think it was cortisone flushing. I think it was, I haven't been out in the sun very much, and I got a little sunburn, even though I had SPF 15 on, wasn't enough. So, because that's all gone now. I think it was, you know, I got a little sun yesterday, which was great. So my experience of having the injection was great. They didn't take away my shot, I got my shot. So I had to make some Hamilton references there. And in terms of how I felt, the one thing I'm noticing, the last two nights I didn't sleep great the night before the procedure because I was super anxious. The last two nights I have slept much better. And last night even better than the first night. I put on a show at like 9:30, and at the 10 o'clock hour, I realized I had missed most of it. So I wanted to watch the new season of Nine Perfect Strangers. And I saw the first maybe 10 minutes of it, and then I saw the rest through my closed eyes. So I'm going to have to rewatch that. But I'm sleeping better because I'm in a lot less pain. So the pain that's left, I don't have, so the intense nerve pain, I don't have the intense nerve pain in my back or my butt or running down my leg and into my, into my lower leg. I do still have the numbness on the lateral side of my left thigh. I think that's improved a little bit. But in terms, and then that unsteadiness that I'm not sure is from the shot or from the stenosis itself, there's still a little bit of that left, but it's only been 2 days. So for 48 hours, you're supposed to take it really easy. And I decided not to do my PT exercises until last night. So I didn't do any extra exercise. I walked yesterday to go to the Boombox Parade, and then I did the PT exercises last night. Did the PT exercises this morning. I'll probably do restorative yoga tonight. I'm going to take it super easy until Tuesday when I see Dr. Melosi again, and then I'll find out when I'm allowed to get on my bike, if I'm allowed to get on my bike, and what is the likelihood that I'm going to have surgery after all. I know they're trying to put off the surgery by doing the injections, and they must feel that I have enough support in my back, because Ron, there was no CSF getting into his cervical spine, and he was in danger. Like, if he fell, he could have become paralyzed. They must not think that about me. And I only am compromised on the left side, which is pretty interesting, because the, I guess the stenosis leans to the left. So I'll find out more about what I'm allowed to do, when I'm allowed to get back on the bike, because you're allowed to resume your normal activity. They say no strenuous activity for at least a week. And so a week will be, you know, that'll be Thursday. So if I wanted to get back on the bike on Saturday the 11th, or Saturday the 12th, I could. So we'll see about that. If I see how I'm feeling, and I'll ask. Now, Dr. Joe, who did my procedure, he said that if I was going to go see Dr. Malozzi on the 8th, that's probably too soon. That you won't have the full benefits of the treatment yet. So that's interesting. So that means that this is going to get better and better. And I think there's a little less, even though I still have the numbness and tightness on the left side and the lateral side of my left thigh, it may continue to improve. So that's exciting. But the gross nerve pain that made it hard for me to sit for a long time, that's gone. I don't have the nerve pain in my back or my butt, or the extreme nerve pain in my thigh when I step on it, nor in my leg. So that's very exciting. I do feel kind of like lying around. So after, going out and about yesterday, had to try to go to the pharmacy for Ron, and I missed the pharmacy. The pharmacy closed at 2 because it was, it was 4th of July. So I'll go today, and I'll be able to get some more stuff done. But I do want to spend more time resting. So I'll do this and then I'll rest. So it's very interesting. So if you have to get a cortisone shot in your back, I had a really good experience. Not everybody will, but I did. And I didn't have any major side effects at all. And I'm very pleased, and I would do it again if I had. You don't do it a lot because it's not good to get cortisone all the time. But now that I know it's NBD, no big deal, I'm not going to be anxious about it again because it worked. It was helpful so far, and we have to see how far along it is helpful. So I continue to take things to help to nourish that nerve. I'm taking phosphatidylserine. Phosphatidylserine is part of the myelin sheath. It's a phospholipid that helps to cover that nerve. I am taking acetyl L-carnitine, which is a great amino acid that is helpful for nerve pain. So I'm taking 2 grams of that a day. I'm taking 2 caps in the morning and powder in my tea at night. And so that's probably helping. I take curcumin. I take fish oil. I take black cumin seed oil. So I'm taking a lot of anti-inflammatory things. So those things are probably all helping with the inflammation. And I consume a lot of antioxidants. And, I'm going to start doing the ube latte. If I can do the ube and the matcha without getting too caffeinated, I'll probably do that too, because those have wonderful antioxidants. And I am taking a green tea, a decaffeinated green tea pill as well. So I got a lot of antioxidants on board. So that's what's going on with my health. And it was a very interesting experience for me, and I wanted to share it in this format. So let's talk about acetyl L-carnitine, the benefits of acetyl L-carnitine. Acetyl L-carnitine is made from plain L-carnitine. It's made in the body. They're used to help the body turn fat into energy. Will I lose some weight from taking it? I don't know. That's one of the things people like to take to help with fat loss. I don't know if it's going to help me lose fat, but that's not why I'm taking it. Acetyl L-carnitine. So the interesting thing about acetyl L-carnitine is the acetyl group. When I dump the powder into my tea, I smell vinegar. The tea doesn't taste like vinegar, but I smell the vinegar, and I'm just wondering if some of the acetyl is coming off, and that's what I'm smelling. I'm smelling acetic acid because it's when as it breaks off, or it just smells like that when it goes in because acetyl is acetic acid is basically an acetyl group with a hydroxyl group, and that's acetic acid. That's vinegar. And so it's important for a lot of body processes. L-carnitine is made in the brain, liver, and kidneys, and your body can convert L-carnitine to acetyl L-carnitine, and it can go back and forth. And it's not clear if the effects of the acetyl L are from the chemical itself or from the L-carnitine it can make or from something else entirely. So they use acetyl L-carnitine sometimes for dementia, like Alzheimer's disease, for improving memory and thinking skills, also for depression, and of course, for reducing nerve pain, especially in people with diabetes. It's used for lots of other conditions. The scientific evidence is supposedly sketchy. It may be effective for when you have decline in your memory and thinking skills that happen with age. If you take it by mouth, it can improve memory and mental function in people with memory loss. It can also help with fatigue in older adults. If you take it by mouth, it might help your mental and physical tiredness and reduce tiredness after exercise. So that's exciting. So what do they use it for? They use it for alcohol use disorder. If you give acetyl L-carnitine IV for 10 days and then take it by mouth for 80 days, it can help withdrawal symptoms and cravings during alcohol detox. But it's possible that's only when you do it IV, intravenously. It can be helpful for depression. So I should be cheerier because I'm taking 2 grams and the dose is 1 to 4 grams. It can improve mood and decrease depression in some people. It tends to work better in older people when taken in higher amounts. Nerve pain. The studies are on diabetes, which I do not have. I'm taking it for nerve pain from injury. So it helps with diabetic neuropathy. You can take 2 or 3 grams a day, and it can help improve symptoms in people with nerve pain from diabetes. And it can be helpful for male infertility. So if you take it, the acetyl L plus the plain L-carnitine, it tends to increase sperm movement and maybe sperm count in males with fertility problems. And they're not sure if it's the acetyl L-carnitine alone or if just the chance of getting pregnant is improved. It may not work for nerve damage in the hands or feet caused by cancer drug treatment. I don't usually use acetyl L-carnitine for that. When people have neuropathy from chemotherapy, I usually like to use L-glutamine, and L-glutamine can be helpful. So there can be some side effects. It can cause stomach upset, nausea, vomiting, dry mouth, headache, and restlessness, and also a fishy odor of the urine, breath, and sweat. The fishy odor might be happening. Everything else, I have not had an issue with that. It's likely safe for most people, and there's not reliable evidence as to whether you should take it during pregnancy and breastfeeding. It could worsen your bipolar disorder, so we use it for straight-up depression, not bipolar disorder. As we say, it might worsen symptoms in some people who have neuropathy because of chemotherapy. That it could interfere with thyroid hormone. So if you're hypothyroid, it's not the best thing to take. You can use other things. L-carnitine can make seizures more likely in people who have a history of seizures. And there's a concern that if you use acetyl-L, that's going to be an issue. So you're not supposed to use Coumadin or warfarin with acetyl-L-carnitine. It can increase it can cause more bleeding and other drugs that increase blood clotting. They're Coumadin derivatives. It doesn't say anything about if you're taking one of the 10A inhibitors like apixaban or rivaroxaban, which is Xarelto and Eliquis. And serotonergic drugs. It can increase serotonin, which is why it's going to help with your depression. So if you're also taking an SSRI or anything that increases serotonin, so if you're taking, say, sertraline, Zoloft, or if you're taking fluoxetine, which is Prozac, or if you're taking, there's a number of drugs. If you're taking an anti-anxiety or anti-depression drug that increases serotonin, whatever, if you're taking one of those drugs, check to see if it raises serotonin, because I don't want to list them all here at the moment. You know, so Effexor, for an amitriptyline, for example, raises both norepinephrine and serotonin. So you have to be careful when you're taking that. If you're already hypothyroid, it can make that worse. So that's the deal with acetyl L-carnitine. Very exciting. All right. So now let's talk about why women in menopause need to eat, right? How many of my menopausal patients come to see me and they really, really want to lose weight? And what can happen is that women might wind up not eating enough during their perimenopause. So if you eat less than your active body needs, it can lead to long-term damage. And here's what you should know. And this is written by my buddy Celine Yeager. A few years ago, we had Celine Yeager on our show on Radio Naturopath by phone. Went back when we were in the studio. And so she's very smart. She writes for Women's Health. She's written books. She writes columns in various magazines. And where I have seen her is Women's Health. Women have been steeped in diet culture our whole lives. Commercials, celebrities, and even doctors and coaches tell us that thinner is better. A lot of us have struggled with disordered eating or eating disorders our whole lives in the quest to be thin, and eating more was not a thing that we looked for. That can all get magnified during the menopause transition, so our hormones change, our bodies change, and we struggle to gain control through the only means many of us know, watch what we eat, which is eating less. That can backfire in that it doesn't necessarily lead to weight or fat loss, but also can be a serious detriment to the performance and shorten long-term health. And this is promoted by Heidi Skolnick, who's a nutritionist and who wrote The Whole Body Reset in Hit Play, Not Pause. And they talk about why menopausal athletes need to eat more. So this is something Celine Yeager says. This is something that Stacey Sims says, who is a PhD in female in nutrition and kinesiology, and talks about menopausal women and exercise. And the other one is my buddy Marissa Axel, who promotes women cyclists, the forgotten athlete, women menopausal cyclists. You have to eat enough calories to get to promote your workout. So the damaging impact of low energy availability. Hear that? That having not enough calories can be damaging. When you don't eat enough as an active woman, you can slip into a state known as low energy availability, LEA or LEA, which sets the stage for relative energy deficiency in sport, red S, a condition that, according to research, can result in irreversible health and performance impairments, including decreases in metabolism, poor hormone function, bone loss, lower immunity, impaired protein synthesis, fatigue, depression, anxiety, impaired digestion, and increased risk for cardiovascular disease. The female athlete triad, a term used to define the relationship between energy availability, hormonal status, and bone health, falls under red S, and one of the hallmarks of red S for women is menstrual dysfunction or loss of periods altogether. If you're in the menopause transition or postmenopausal, you may not have the obvious red flag of losing your menses, your period. But there are plenty of other signs, said nutritionist Skolnick, who specializes in the athlete triad at the Women's Sports Medicine Center at the hospital for special surgery, and wrote the Athlete Triad Playbook, and who sits on the Medical Advisory Committee of the National Menopause Foundation. For menopausal women who can't afford to lose more bone and muscle than we already do, it's important to know the signs so you can address LEA as soon as possible, or prevent it in the first place. So how LEA and red S show up, it impacts every part of your body and can show up in many ways. If you're still getting your period, you may stop menstruating. You may also notice an array of physical and psychological symptoms. You may feel irritable, have brain fog, dry, brittle hair and nails, cold hands and feet, be bloated and constipated, losing muscle, have decreased bone density, experience more injury, and not respond to training. If those symptoms sound familiar, it's because they're also symptoms we can experience in perimenopause. It can be challenging to tease out what is the root cause of what you're experiencing, but if you're very active and also restricting your food or dieting, don't just assume perimenopause. There's a good chance you are not fueling enough. It's important to recognize that you might still be able to perform well in the early stages of LEA, even while the rest of your physiology is suffering. You're working out, you're training for your sport, you're able to go to practice, you may not feel fatigued, especially in the beginning, but we still have our physiology we need to feed. We have to feed our organs, heart, our lungs, kidneys, and support our growth, repair, and recovery. When we aren't taking enough calories, we have energy available to work out, but low energy availability for the rest of our physiology. That's low energy availability, explains Skolnick. So your body is going to go to the most important thing first. And if you're in fight or flight, which is what your body is going to think of as your workout, the energy is going to go to that. And then when you're resting, if you're depleted, you're not going to be able to recover well. And so your workouts aren't going to be good, and you're just not going to feel good in general. So if you work with a sports nutritionist, even for a few sessions, it can help determine if you're running into LEA territory and ensure that you're fueling appropriately for the activity you're doing and make you perform better. So to avoid LEA and red S, it's easy to say, eat enough. But red S wouldn't be so common if it were easy to do. Sometimes women slip into LEA and red S unintentionally by neglecting to pay attention to fueling needs. Sometimes it's because they're intentionally restricting what they eat. Avoiding both of these situations takes a mindful and intentional approach. So you gotta adjust your mindset. LEA is often a consequence of our mindset, which of course affects our behavior. We need to change our mindset, self-talk, and the language we use to help change our behavior, which means normalizing eating and being strong. We should stop using words like cheat day and clean eating. It sets you up to binge and feel guilty, Skolnick says. The only time you should feel guilty about something you ate is if you stole it. And the only time food is not clean is if it fell in the mud or on the floor. Also, be careful about engaging in fat talk, she says. Saying, look at me, I'm so fat, seems normative and like we're commiserating with each other. But really, those who engage in fat talk have the most body dissatisfaction. It's damaging to the people who engage. It's damaging to the people who hear it. And it makes it normative to women, for women to not like our bodies. And it makes it harder to eat and fuel yourself. So one of the things you want to try to do is eat 2/3 of your calories in the first 2/3 of your day. Drinking water. Your hunger hormone ghrelin increases when you undereat during the day, so you get hungrier as the day goes on. That's a problem for proper fueling because people end up overcompensating when they do eat, setting them up for a vicious cycle. Skolnick remembers trying to eat 2/3 of your calories the first 2/3 of your day. That's not to say you need to count calories. You don't. You don't need to count calories. The idea is to eat throughout the day in a more even pattern that matches your activity levels, which tend to taper off by the time most of us consume our biggest meal. By eating more earlier, you'll have better energy, concentration, mood, and appetite regulation. Skip. All right, wait for it. Are you ready for this? Are you ready for this? I'm probably going to say it a few times, but hear me now. Skip intermittent fasting. All these people, Stacy Sims, Celine Yeager, who's the other one? And Marissa Axel. Intermittent fasting, no good. They are not big on intermittent fasting. If a patient comes in and she says she's doing intermittent fasting and she's doing well on it, it depends on the interval. If she's saying she's doing 12-12 or 14-10, that's less concerning. But if she's doing 8-16, where she's eating for 8 hours and fasting for 16, I might discourage that. What I try to do, if a patient is not sure what to do, I discourage them from intermittent fasting. And this is not for men, because the studies on intermittent fasting were done on young men. They were not done on postmenopausal, peri- and postmenopausal women. And so intermittent fasting is not good for peri- and postmenopausal women, whether they are exercising or not, because it's stressful on the body. And it's that whole leptin-ghrelin thing. If your body feels like it's not getting enough calories, it's going to increase your cortisol, and that is going to start to eat away at your tissues. So cortisol's job is to run around, look for tissue to break down so that you can put sugar into your blood so you can run away from the bear. And if you underfeed yourself, your body is going to feel stressed, and you're going to raise your cortisol. And the whole point of working out is you want to get stronger. You want your muscles to be stronger and more functional. And you want, if you're building your cardio, you want your heart and your lungs to be stronger. They are muscles too. They're smooth muscles. So if you are under stress, every one of your structures is at risk. So your heart, your lungs, your bones, and your muscles, and your nerves, and your brain are all at risk of being eaten away at, being broken down. So intermittent fasting is not really a good idea for peri- and postmenopausal women. It was studied for young men, and I don't even know if it's entirely good for them, but it's certainly not good for us. I'm 61 years old, not good for me, Fran, and I don't do it. And I try to discourage most of my patients from doing it. It's a popular weight loss strategy. It's questionable that it's actually superior to any other kinds of energy restriction. Research also indicates that it can be problematic in women and actually increases stress, what I just said, worsens insulin sensitivity, and may cause hormonal disruption as our bodies respond to energy restriction differently than men do. So men have way more muscle mass than we do. And so they can, if they're not eating, their muscles will still be very active and burning fat, whereas we don't have muscle mass like they do, most of us. I mean, you can't say one-to-one, but in general, women do not have the same muscle mass that men do. And so absolutely intermittent fasting, what I said, makes it hard to maintain muscle. You need to hit 25 grams of protein in the morning to press that anabolic muscle building button. What's more, research has shown that when people lose weight through intermittent fasting, they lose more than 60% of it, from muscle, rather than the 30% people usually lose in the form of muscle when they lose weight by other means. Muscle is hard to come by as we age, and we want it. So sarcopenia is a risk as we age anyway because of our hormonal status, how our hormones change. So sarcopenia is the loss of muscle mass, of lean tissue. And so we want to maintain what we already have, and if we can, continue to add it. And studies have shown that you can add muscle mass at any age. If you take 80-some-year-old people and you put them on a resistance training program, they will gain muscle mass. You can stimulate muscle mass at any age. And so we want to continue to put it on. So intermittent fasting is a terrible strategy, according to Skolnick. She doesn't see the benefits over the drawbacks. If you want to intermittent fast, that's what sleep is for. So when you sleep, you're not eating. So stop eating at 8 p.m. and eat breakfast the next morning at 8 a.m. That's 12 hours. You've just done an intermittent fast. So 12 to 12, that's okay if you're doing a 12-hour fast. But you're only fasting because you're sleeping. So when you wake up, eat something. Make sure you fuel your workouts and your recovery. Eating before, during, and after your workouts is a good way to avoid slipping into LEA. Also remember that you need to eat on your recovery days too, when many women cut back because they're not exercising. If you want to see improvements from your training, you need to give your body the fuel it needs to restore your glycogen and repair your muscles so you can come back stronger. Also, nail your carbohydrate needs. Don't be so afraid of carbs. Low energy availability often stems from low carbohydrate availability, as so many women and men are still afraid that eating carbs will make them gain fat. When it comes to immunity and bone health, some studies suggest that carbohydrate restriction is more detrimental to both than not getting calories overall. So all that keto dieting people do, it's not really that good for you. It's a great way to lose weight fast, but most people can't maintain it. There are some people who do ketogenic diets and it makes them feel good, and I don't necessarily stop them, but most of my patients can't maintain a ketogenic diet, and I say, you can't maintain it, it's because your body doesn't want you to. So most athletes' needs vary from 5 to 8 grams per kilogram of body weight, and Skolnick says, but you may need even upwards of 10 grams per kilogram depending on your sport. That's I believe that's of protein. Or no, it's a carbohydrates. Spread your protein out over the course of the day. You don't store protein like you store carbohydrates. And you can only synthesize so much at one time, so you need to spread it out throughout the day. The goal is to have 25 to 30 grams of protein 3 or 4 times a day, coupled with strength training to help you maintain your muscle, which is crucial for health and well-being across the board. Eat intuitively and on schedule. It might sound like the two can't coexist, but they can, and for active women, they should. You can be intuitive about your meals and tune into what and how much you feel like eating, but as an athlete, sometimes you also have to be more strategic because you have a training schedule, Skolnick says. For instance, you might have a hard training session after work, so you don't want to wait until dinner time after you're done to eat. Instead, you'll need to plan a snack around 4 o'clock so you have a good training session and aren't left depleted and ravenous when you're done. Likewise, after a hard workout, you may not feel hungry, but having a little snack while your body is primed to replenish glycogen and repair your muscles will not only jumpstart your recovery, but also help you avoid going into the bottomless hunger pit that can hit later if you skip your recovery snack. So protein and carbs after you've done your workout, preferably within the first half hour, because your body's very primed to accept the protein and carbs. So there it goes, and that's the... That's the idea, that you want to make sure that you're eating adequately. If you are a peri or postmenopausal woman, intermittent fasting is not a good idea for you, unless you're doing 12 to 12, 12 and 12, that you're eating for 12 hours and not eating for 12 hours. That's okay. And when you are not eating, you should be asleep. You should be in bed sleeping. And if you're awake, you probably want to be eating because you need to fuel your life. You need to fuel your workouts. You need to fuel your recovery. And so a lot of women run into this, that they are afraid to eat because they don't want to gain too much weight. And that I know I have friends and colleagues who undereat chronically and have a lot of health issues because of that. And that would not be, I don't think I undereat chronically. I try to get some kind of protein with all of my meals and maybe with a snack as well. So in the morning, I don't feel like eating a lot. So she says, eat 2/3 of your calories first, which I think I do. You know, I eat because I eat breakfast and I eat lunch. In the morning, I usually have, because I'm not super hungry, I will have a protein shake. So a bunch of grams of protein first thing in the morning that way. And my favorite, personal favorite protein that agrees with my body and works well for me is bone broth protein. And if I had a beef protein, that would be fine too. or a chicken based protein. Either way, chicken or beef-based protein works for me. I don't do whey. Whey tears up my stomach, and I'm not as excited about vegan proteins. If you're a vegan or you prefer vegetarian protein, it agrees with you, by all means. There are good benefits to yellow pea protein. Yellow pea protein is good for your kidneys. So if you have hypertension, like I could have some yellow pea protein. And sometimes if I have a protein bar, it'll have yellow pea protein in it, which I'll eat. For my lunches, I'm often having turkey breast or chicken breast. I'm having beans. I'm having some kind of, a chickpea salad or some other kind of salad with beans in it. And dinner time, I have some kind of protein, whether it's chicken or fish or something like that. And with nuts and seeds, and I have nuts and seeds usually at the end of the day in my salad. So I'm getting some extra protein that way. If I'm hungry later in the day, I'm a fan of good quality meat sticks. So there's a number of brands that have no added nitrates and they're cleanly raised. And I will use that in a pinch as well. Those are good quality protein as well. So I try to tell people eat protein 3 or 4 times a day and 25 to 30 grams each time. And understand that if you have all your protein at night, you're not going to benefit it as much. You're going to excrete some of it. And if you have a little at a time throughout the day, you're much more likely to lay it on, to take it in, to absorb it, and to have it used as structure. You have to remember too that in terms of calories, if you're worried about the calories in protein, your body is not that excited about using protein as a source of calories. It's much more interested in using carbohydrates and fat. So when you eat protein, your body's first reaction to it is going to look at it and it's going to break it down into amino acids and then use it for all the things you use protein for, which is generally structure and enzymes. So you will use that protein to build muscle mass, and that's your musculoskeletal muscle, your skeletal muscles, which is what we want to build if we're trying to get fit. And you're also going to use it to build organ tissue. The other thing you use protein for is to make enzymes. So you have all kinds of enzymatic processes in your body, especially the digestive enzymes. So you need amino acids. Those are proteins. So you need amino acids to build those. When you use enzymes in your body, when they're tapped out, they get broken down into amino acids. Your body reabsorbs the amino acids and then uses it for whatever it needs, more enzymes or making your bicep or making your heart, whatever it is. So eating adequate protein is very important. And eating adequate carbohydrate. Now, if you don't want to gain weight, then you want to look at not eating refined carbohydrates, eating whole grains, eating beans, eating sweet potatoes, eating a little regular potato, eating if you are not allergic to wheat, you can do sourdough bread. So you're going to get some good quality carbohydrates, eating quinoa, eating cassava, eating ube with those purple sweet potatoes. Getting good quality carbohydrates on board is important. If you don't feel good, and I mean, this doesn't mean never eat sweets. If you want to eat a little bit of sweets, figure it into your diet, but don't eat that instead of eating the healthy carbohydrates. And if you want to lose a little bit of fat, the thing to do is to focus on doing resistance training and eating adequate protein and watching your junk carbs. Don't eat too many of those, which doesn't mean never eat any of them, but don't eat too many junk carbs. But do eat good quality carbs, like I said, like your quinoa, your brown rice, your oats, your any kind of bean or legume, like lentils, nuts and seeds. So anything with good quality carbohydrates in it. So that's what you do for your healthy menopause. So we're not here to promote not excited about cutting carbs too much. All right, so we're gonna go a little bit into let me see. So should women cut carbs? This is from Feisty Menopause as well. And should men, so I'm gonna start this, but I'm not gonna finish it because we're running out of time. So high carb, no carb, low carb, women in menopause get a whole lot of mixed messages, and this is also by Celine Yeager, my buddy. When you look at the internet long enough, you're going to be convinced that carbohydrates are the devil incarnate, and they are not. Active menopausal women perform best when they're well-fueled, and that includes carbohydrates, which are a primary fuel source for exercise, especially for higher intensity efforts. And Marissa Axel, if you read Marissa Axel, and if you are a cyclist, and you are peri and postmenopausal, consider looking at Marissa Axel. Even if you're not, even if you're younger, look at Marissa Axel, because she really, all about the forgotten athlete, and she's mostly focused on peri and postmenopausal women. Not a fan of, very much in line with Celine Yeager and Stacey Sims in terms of no intermittent fasting, eating adequate carbohydrates, eating adequate protein, eating adequate calories. And so this is something else I wanted to talk about. So maybe I'll hang up this article and go into it next week. But counting calories is probably not necessary. What you need to do is eat when you're hungry, don't eat when you're not. And don't necessarily stuff yourself. You'd use that term of harahachibu, which is the Japanese principle of eating until you're 80% full. And eat as healthfully as you can. Eat the rainbow. Eat lots of fruits and vegetables. Eat clean protein. And like we said, 25 to 30 grams of protein three times a day, but four if you can do it. And do eat clean eat good carbohydrates. And feed your hunger. If you're hungry, that means your body's telling you need to eat. I'm going to need to eat something very soon as well. And don't let yourself get too hungry, and don't worry about calories. Just try not to eat junk. Try not to eat too much junk food, but don't never eat junk food. If you're going to go to Rangina's after your, cortisone shot, go have a latte and have a pastry, but just don't pound tons of pastries every single day. So anyway, so that's the big point for today. I think this is a great article entitled Should Menopausal Women Cut Carbs? So we are going to take this up next week. So I'm going to let you go right now, and we'll, let you know how the healing process is going with myself and Ron next week as well. All right. So you have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza is downstairs recovering from surgery. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.